Right now it's time for Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and I'm really delighted to bring you another edition of Talking Animals, in which we'll be speaking with author Charles Siebert about his new book, The Wachula Woods Accord, and his chimp friend Roger, amongst other things. First, though, as always, we're kicking off the show with an animal tune. This is Combustible Edison with a piece called One-Eyed Monkey here on Talking Animals. This is Combustible Edison, with a piece called One-Eyed Monkey, an animal tune of sorts, as we ease into today's edition of Talking Animals. My name's Duncan Strauss, here with our program that is devoted to all subjects in the animal kingdom. In just a few minutes, we'll be speaking with today's guest, author Charles Siebert, whose new book, The Wachula Woods Accord, among other things, chronicles his extended encounter with a retired circus chimp named Roger at a chimpanzee sanctuary in Wachula, Florida. Also, Charles periodically writes major pieces about animals for the New York Times Magazine, typically cover stories. We'll talk about all those things and more when we speak with Charles Siebert in a few moments here on Talking Animals. And as usual, we'll also welcome your questions and comments at 813-239-9663 or by email at dj@wmnf.org. Time now for a couple of quick animal news items and or announcements, as we take a leave to. I want to first tell you that Cat Call Inc. and Florida Cocker Spaniel Rescue Inc. will host a special adoption event on Saturday, August 22nd at Bloomingdale Pet Supply in the Brandon-Valrico area. Specific details, it's going to involve cats, kittens, dogs, and puppies all up for adoption. Again, it's August 22nd from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. at Bloomingdale Pet Supply in Valrico. Phone number there, 813-662-9296. And for more information about the event, call Janine at 813-657-7078. And what may be a first, we have an announcement about us. Talking Animals looking for a production outreach coordinator. This is a volunteer position to help me with various aspects of producing the program and getting the word out more effectively about shows, forthcoming guests, special events, and more. Ideally, this person would have considerable familiarity with social networks like Facebook and Twitter. If you're interested and can spare a few hours each month, please email me at talkinganimals@aol.com. All right, let's step into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner, which involves animal-oriented comedy. This is Matt Bronger with part of a piece called Owls on today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
Anyway, Harry Potter. Like, I like them, I like the books, I like the movies, but I think they send the wrong message to our kids. And that's that it's okay to own an owl for a pet. No. Okay? I'm from Oregon, I know. Owls are made of claws, feathers, and hatred. That's it. Like, owls don't give a crap. You ever look at an owl, the rage and hatred in his eyes? Up in a tree, like, who? Who? Who's next to die? It's you, mouse! Owl! And I'm back. Hating everything that lives. Hey. It's kind of like 101 Dalmatians. You remember when that movie came out and all the kids wanted Dalmatians for Christmas? Even though the Dalmatians are the most insane dog in dog land. They are. You throw a stick to a Dalmatian and come back with his own leg torn off. Yeah. Is that what you threw? I didn't even look. Ha ha! Dalmatian! They yell their own name like Geronimo. I mean, that's why firemen have them. They're the only animal that'll run in a burning house like it's a regular house. You know?
All right, that was Matt Bronger with part of a piece called Owls, taken from his Letterman debut. I'm Duncan Strauss. This is Talking Animals. Our website is talkinganimals.net, where we make available all sorts of information and content about Talking Animals, including podcasts of past programs. We also have a link to the Talking Animals Facebook page and more, and including a place to subscribe to our email newsletter so we can keep you posted on forthcoming guests, program news, and more. That's Talking Animals www.charlesieber.net. It's nearly time to speak with today's guest, Charles Sieber. So let me outline a few things about him. As I noted earlier in the show, he's the author, most recently, of the Wachula Woods Accord, Toward a New Understanding of Animals, which chronicles his extended encounter with a retired circus chimp named Roger at the Center for Great Apes, a chimpanzee sanctuary just down the road a piece from here in Wachula, Florida. Actually, as the book unfolds, it widens out considerably from the personal reportage of that encounter, with Charles weaving in impressions from visits he made to other chimp sanctuaries, scientific findings, and other literature dealing with the man-ape connection, as well as anecdotal info and reporting about other animals. Indeed, Charles has also written a number of New York Times magazine covers about animals and animal issues. So much to cover here. So with a reminder, we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing us at dj@wmnf. Let's welcome Charles Siebert to Talking Animals. Welcome, Charles.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Thanks so much for joining us on Talking Animals.
My pleasure.
So, of course, I want to delve headlong into the book, which we'll do in a moment. But first, I'd just kind of like to ask about the circumstances under which you began writing about animals.
Well, for a kid from Brooklyn, New York, it is a little strange when I think of it. I guess I was always that kid in my limited city experience with animals, you know, who liked to linger for a long time in the ape house staring at the chimpanzee. It was one of my fantasies as a kid to be left behind at the zoo by my parents. Not exactly the ideal situation for the animals, of course, but as a kid in the city, that was my first contact. And I think just as a poet, which is what I started out writing exclusively, I always loved the poems by poets like Rainer Maria Rilke, who, you know, had a number of poems about just sitting in the Jardin des Plantes in Paris, staring at animals. And, you know, there's just something so profound about staring up close at a wild animal or another, even staring at your dog, for that matter, and however compromised that situation is in a zoo. So I was always just moved by that, and I found that in my early essay writing for Harper's Magazine and other, I started thinking about us and animals and the way we portray them on nature shows and the way we used to keep them in the old inner city zoos and that kind of thing. And it just sort of grew from there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so, to what extent do you think specific singular experiences you've subsequently had with animals that most of your readers maybe haven't had, like, you know, face-to-face encounters with elephants and friendly whales in San Ignacio Lagoon and Roger, of course. I mean, to what extent do those fuel your writing? I mean, it seemed like it was, you know, after all, it was Roger's kind of a striking response to you upon first meeting and no less striking connection forged at that meeting that sort of represents the impetus for this new book, right?
Yeah, I mean, the encounter with Roger, in a way, it's one of the more common encounters that a person would have, a chimpanzee in captivity, even though, you know, his situation is better than a lot of the former entertainers get. But what it did is it set off for me in my mind, you know, the nature of the close encounter with animals that I've had. And very early on, I had an experience of traveling both in the Amazon to write a story for Esquire, and then in the jungles of Belize to write about a, ironically enough, another guy from Brooklyn named Alan Rabinowitz, who's a famous conservation biologist.
Sure.
He established the first jaguar reserve down in Belize in the jungles there. And I camped out with him and trekked with him through the jungles for a few weeks. And we had a very close sort of face-to-face moment with a jaguar who sort of was just, they are the apex predator down there. And many of them hadn't even encountered a person. So he just sort of, this jaguar just sort of came out and gave us a good long look and then skulked back into the jungle. And there's something about that kind of experience, which is getting rarer and rarer on the planet, that I find so exceptional. And that begot my curiosity and drive to go to all these other places that I've been since, as you mentioned, elephants in Africa and the whales in Baja and a bunch of others. So it's been a good life that way.
For sure. Well, let me let our listeners know that if you just tuned in, we're speaking with the writer Charles Siebert, whose new book is The Wachula Woods Accord, Toward a New Understanding of Animals. You might also know his work from various New York Times cover stories, magazine cover stories, including one just last month on whales. And if you'd like to join the conversation, ask Charles a question, please call 813-239-9663, or you can email us at dj@wmnf.com. Roger Miller.org. So with Roger in mind, I mean, however many months this is after that sort of rather intense hang time that you did have with Roger, what stands as the single most resonant aspect of that experience, and has it shifted really since that period at all?
Well, you know, that whole thing happened because I was traveling around the country, sort of visiting with captive chimpanzees all over the country in various facilities, the new retirement home that the government set up under the Chimp Act for former research lab chimpanzees, and they have a rather elaborate retirement facility just outside of Shreveport, Louisiana. I think it's going to be a better version of retirement than I'll ever get in my own life. But
yeah.
But then some very hard places, the former Colston Foundation, where these research lab chimps were kept in very, very desperate and depressing conditions. But anyway, somewhere along the line, someone said, you have to go to Wachula to visit Patty Reagan's place. She has a facility for former entertainment chimps. Carol Noon told me this. She is the now late Carol Noon, has a facility in Fort Pierce, Florida, for most of those are former research lab chimps.
Yeah.
And Carol told me, you have to go visit Patty. So I went up to her place sort of as the last stop in my tour, and it was there that I had this encounter with Roger, where he sort of stood up and clapped upon seeing me, and it elicited in me the eerie sense that he kind of recognized me from, and this, of course, could all be in my imagination, but I was taken with the sort of intensity of his response. And I asked Patty if I couldn't, I'm not sure she gets this kind of request very often, but I asked if I couldn't move in to be with Roger for a while. And I did that some months after that initial encounter, and she graciously allowed me to come down there. She has a little cottage, and I had the unique experience of basically for a brief time retiring with former chimp actors and entertainers and orangutans. And living there, and day after day, I sat with Roger, and we just sort of stared at each other.
Yeah, absolutely, and which brings me to Charles. For those listeners who haven't had a chance yet to read the book, maybe you can just take a moment and sort of talk a bit about your now very related notion to what you just described of the human Z.
Yeah, I actually originally wanted to call the book Human Z.
Yeah,
which refers to this putative actual hybrid that there have been actual attempts to make of a chimp and a human being, and I mean biologically to create this in a laboratory. But I sort of more meant it in the figurative sense that chimps like Roger, who grow up in captivity around people and work with people for as many as 6, 7 of their or 10 of their early years, they get to prefer the company of people. They didn't grow up with other chimps, so they sort of are weirdly suspended between their former chimp selves and the kind of half human beings that we're trying to coax them into being. And so, humanzees. And Roger was had a lot of the chimps and orangutans that Patty deals with there. It takes a long time to sort of bring them down off of their human dependencies. The zoos won't take these animals because they're highly asocial. So Patty spends a lot of her time trying to socialize these chimps. They're very social animals in the wild. They have incredibly elaborate social hierarchies. And Roger was one who was very resistant for the longest time to being socialized with the other chimps. When I was there, he was the only chimp that lived alone, and he had all kinds of nervous tics and insomnia. And what people don't realize is, as I say about chimps and other animals like whales, like dolphins, like orangutans, they have minds enough to lose and memories that can hasten that process. And that's an interesting and burdensome knowledge to have now, that they actually suffer the same sorts of trauma that humans do.
Yeah, well, in fact, let me just skip ahead to that because I think that's a really, really interesting notion. And I want to stick with chimps and Roger. I guess want to just quickly touch on, as someone with a particular passion for elephants, I was really struck by the New York Times piece he did about 3 years ago on elephants experiencing something akin to post-traumatic stress disorder. And bits of that were sort of echoed in the new book as well. So for me, I guess the most disturbing part of this phenomenon was that it wasn't just elephants in captivity kind of losing their marbles, but elephants in the wild as well. So
I
was just going to say, from your reporting and travels and pondering all this, what might we extrapolate to chimps and other animals from what has now been documented in the case of the, not just the captive again, but the wild elephants as well?
Well, we now have to carry with us the knowledge. Whatever we make of this is to be seen. But we have to carry with us now the knowledge that there are other, not just intelligences out there comparable or parallel to our own, but that there are cultures, that they have elaborate cultures, and that we are potentially breaking down those cultures and destroying that. It became very apparent to me that that's the case with whales and dolphins, who are in the whale family, of course. But that piece for me in particular, and of course we kind of intuit that with chimpanzees, but to do that elephant story, to go out and actually try to document the breakdown, the nervous breakdown of a species in the wild. And as you say, one of the more alarming things for me was to see that we could actually have the power to make of another creature's wild habitat the equivalent of a madness-inducing cell like you said, they're suffering from the same pathologies as captive circus elephants. How could we do this? Well, we can do it by so cordoning off their natural habitat, so bisecting their corridors of travel, so breaking down, and this was the key thing, and this is so analogous to human culture, breaking down their society to the extent that there aren't enough mothers and extended grandmothers and allomothers and the matriarchal hierarchy that brings up these elephants. And guess what? Without them, what do you get? You get wilding bands of teenage elephants who are killing other elephants, who are killing people madly, and they're raping and murdering rhinoceroses, which is the first time that's ever been seen. And it just shows you, the analogies between breakdown of elephant culture and human culture, the same thing happening with the orphaned child soldiers in Uganda and elsewhere, the parallels are mind-boggling, and it just changes the way, it should change the way we look at the world.
And really as kind of another parallel and maybe yet another measure of just how animals are, at least I think, and obviously you and others do, endlessly fascinating. We've got elephants experiencing something akin to PTSD, yet while other animals are now and in recent years helping relieve the PTSD that soldiers are experiencing in increasing numbers. So, it's an interesting sort of corollary there.
There's a great tale of a woman in L.A. who's using orphan parrots who suffer from stress, post-traumatic stress as well, to heal, as you were saying, soldiers coming back from the war to help heal their stress. So the soldiers working with the parrots from day to day are healing the parrots and vice versa. So how's that for like interspecies cooperation? But here's a dark side of that equation. As now documented very, very poignantly in the movie The Cove, and this is to be my next story for the Times, the dolphins, the very dolphins that are being captured and brought into these swim with dolphins assisted therapy programs, those dolphins are starting to act very aggressively toward the very people they're supposed to be helping to heal, people with autism and with various other traumas. And it's been found out that the reason these dolphins are behaving so erratically is they're the very dolphins who are being taken from these awful drive hunts in Japan. And what these facilities that are having these assisted dolphin therapy sessions are doing is they're paying the fishermen that would kill those dolphins more not to kill them. And so here they get these dolphins who have witnessed the most horrific, near-death experience and watched their fellow dolphins be clubbed to death and pierced to death. And now they're the ones being used for a therapy, and they're going crazy, and they've nearly killed a few people. So the whole thing is so topsy-turvy. And as we know, perhaps of all the creatures we're talking about, the science seems to be that suggests that the dolphins are by far the most advanced in terms of their intelligence. So it's pretty painful to contemplate.
Oh, boy, absolutely. So, yeah, just another, sounds like another round of animals being, you know, deeply traumatized and now starting to see the effects of that. Let me just, again, let our listeners know this is Talking Animals. We're speaking with Charles Siebert, whose new book is The Wachula Woods Accord Toward a New Understanding of Animals. If you'd like to ask Charles a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663 or email us at dj@wmnf.org. Well, so back for just for a moment, Charles, to sort of Roger and beyond, you know, as you mentioned earlier, I mean, part of the book, I mean, you know, the core part is your encounter with Roger, but it's certainly about a lot of other things, including your experiences at other chimp sanctuaries that you visited and reporting at least on some that you didn't, which I guess begs multiple questions, starting with why are there so many chimp sanctuaries? What's your best, you know, estimate of the number of captive chimps in the U.S.? And in broad strokes, you know, from various means I didn't realize, but how did they all get there?
Well, you know, the numbers kind of vary, and Patty Reagan is, you know, far more attuned. I think Patty knows every captive chimp practically in the country, but
sure.
they've gotten there. There's a smaller circle of the kind of chimps that she deals with, which is chimps in entertainment. And, you know, a lot of those are bred in captivity for specifically that purpose.
Yeah.
I think all told, there are maybe in the area of like 2,500 captive chimps in the U.S., something like that.
Mm.
A large number of these are research chimps. And, of course, they were brought over for any number of purposes. Of course, as we know, for the space program, the Air Force had them for a while for that. They were used for seatbelt tests and for toxicology and drug testing. And when their numbers really exponentially shot through the roof is with the outbreak of AIDS back in the or the identification of AIDS back in the 80s, it was assumed wrongly, as it turns out, that chimps, being so close to us biologically, would be perfect models to develop a vaccine. But and so we bred an enormous number. I mean, we just shot up. We just madly bred chimps to work on for this purpose. And it turned out that, as we now seem to understand, the AIDS virus was originally a simian virus that made a zoonotic leap over to humans. And therefore, chimps most often, 9 out of 10 times, can't even get human AIDS, and therefore they were useless as a model.
Yeah.
And so we had all these surplus chimps on our hands. And, you know, the government had a big decision to make. It was one of the last, as I was referring to earlier, the last decision that made under Bill Clinton's administration. And they said, you know, they actually sat down and said, can we put all these chimps down, these chimps that have sacrificed so much for us in terms of offering themselves up for testing? And they decided to do the humane thing and built this great facility in Shreveport for them. But that's they got here both for research purposes and to be co-opted for the entertainment, the benighted entertainment business. People don't realize that these chimps have very short careers in orangutans as entertainers, and then they get too big and strong to control, and they end up spending another 40 to 50 years in captivity. So it's not a very, you know, for a few minutes of our laughter, they get a life behind bars.
Pretty bleak. And this may be an apt moment to touch on the Grade 8 Protection Act, which I guess is now being sort of reintroduced. I don't know if you'd like to sort of just outline the key facets of this bill, which certainly at least is intended to address some of those very numbers in that circumstance.
Yeah, I don't know the exact details. You know, it's part and parcel of a larger, parcel of a larger growing emerging consciousness, this very discomfort we were talking about earlier of, you know, we can't get around anymore the sophistication of these animals, and thus in Spain, for example, apes now or chimps have been accorded a measure of human rights for the first time. And, you know, it just speaks to this is not anthropomorphic conjecture. This isn't sentimentality as it could have been characterized even 10 years ago. Now we have the actual, we know on a biological level, we can look at a chimp brain or an elephant brain or a dolphin brain and compare it to a human brain and see the actual neurons that we all share and the actual physical stunting of those neurons that happens after a traumatic event. So it's no longer, you know, touchy-feely.
Right, conjecture, yeah.
Conjecture. These are the facts Now, how do you want to deal with it? And that's what really came home to me with that elephant story, when I could actually, as a journalist, go past the anecdotal evidence of, hey, they're acting oddly, and actually get an MRI study of a brain and go, uh-oh, you know, these are mammals of the same evolutionary, came along the same evolutionary path as we did. This came up again with the whales, you know, and went in different directions. But this is why I say, no, where it used to be, we can't anthropomorphize because we can't possibly know what a whale day is or a chimp day or an elephant day.
Sure.
Now, through the science, we know that they have days too, parallel days that are equally intricate and as woundable as our own days. And
yeah.
That's where we have to proceed from.
Well, along those lines, and we're just sort of nearing the end of our time here, Charles, I'm afraid, but I've got an email here that says, huge fan of Mr. Siebert's work. As you travel on your book tour and just through your work, have you noticed that people in the U.S. are becoming more enlightened, more sensitized to the plight of animals?
Absolutely. I wish my press were sending me on a wider tour. I might have to generate it myself, but I feel more and more of a deep, deep eagerness to talk about this. That there's just an emergent awareness, and it's not just, you know, people getting carried away about their dogs and their cats. It's just this, you know what it is? It really is the verification of a kind of intuition that human beings have long had. I mean, we used to live way more closer to animals, the overwhelming majority of us, when we were more an agrarian society and in the world, and now we've been moved away from them. Aside from cats and dogs, we've been moved away from, and we certainly left the wilderness a long time ago. So there's this sort of latent desire to reconnect with a kind of with a long-standing bond that we knew we've always had with animals, and now that of all things, we're getting reconnected to that to the old stories about animals we used to tell by science. Science is allowing us to tell those stories again, but with a new detailed kind of knowledge. So, yeah, I think people are dying to these pieces that I write and that other people write get an enormous response because I think people have a deep intuition about this stuff.
Absolutely. Well, we're definitely now at the end of our time, Charles. But, yeah, this, you just touched on one of the many other things I was hoping to get into with you, including the human sense of isolation and loneliness and how that may or may not figure into how we view and treat animals. But I guess we'll save that perhaps for another conversation on the air. But, Charles, thank you so much for making the time to join us today on Talking Animals. Again, the book is The Wachula Woods Accord Toward a New Understanding of Animals, and you made a reference to, I guess, the next New York Times Magazine piece is about dolphins and related issues. When might we look for that?
Well, I don't know if the movie The Cove has now obviated.
Oh, okay.
So the whales that came out a few weeks ago, and now we're trying to put our heads together about where to go next on the animal frontier. But
well, all right. Well, we'll be looking eagerly for the next one, Charles. Thanks again. We really appreciate your fine work, and it's a really wonderful sort of poetic book here, The Wachula Woods Accord. Thanks again.
Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. I'm Duncan Strauss. You are listening to Talking Animals, where the show website is talkinganimals.net. It's time to proceed to name that animal tune, where there'll be a prize, a copy of Charles Siebert's new book, The Wachula Woods Accord. To the first person who calls in and correctly identifies this animal tune. All right, let's name that animal tune. I'm Talking Animal. All right, we've just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals. We may take some of these guesses off the air. The program airs twice a month, specifically the first and second Wednesday of each month. So we'll return Wednesday, September 2nd. I hope you'll join me then. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. We're closing out today's show, as always, with an animal tune. This one quite germane to our conversation with Charles Siebert and about Roger and others. This is the Bare Naked Ladies with another postcard, Chimp Song, on WMNF Tampa. We'll see you September 2nd. Thanks.
You can't imagine so many monkeys in the Daily Mail, and all of them coming anonymously so they leave no trail. Never thought I'd have an IRA from overseas, but someone is sending me stationery filled with chimpanzees. Some chimps in swimsuits, some chimps are swinging from a vine, some chimps in jackboots, some chimps that wish they could be my Starsky and Hutch chimps, a chimp who's sitting on the can, a pair of Dutch chimps who send their love from Amsterdam.
Another bus stop with chimpanzees, and everyone
thinks it's great. He's sending me, maybe she's sending me just to see me get irate. I'm losing sleep and it's really keeping me up all night. I thought it was funny, but now I got money on a monkey fight. Some chimps in hard hats, chimps are working on a chain gang. Some chimps who love cats, burning rubber in a Mustang. A birthday wishing chimp, a chimp in black like a goth, a going fishing chimp, a British chimp in the bar.
Another bus stop with chimps.